Hello. In episode 104 of AS for Architecture, I speak with Paul Watt, visiting professor in the Department of Sociology at the London School of Economics, about his 2021 book, Estate Regeneration and Its Discontents, Public Housing, Place and Inequality in London, published by Bristol University Press.
AS for Architecture, a podcast about architecture, buildings, urban culture and space.
Hello and welcome to another episode of AS for Architecture. I'm talking today to Paul Watt, author, academic, about your writing, particularly recent book, Estate Regeneration and Its Discontents, Public Housing, Place and Inequality in London, which you published with Bristol University Press. Paul, before we get into the book itself, would you be so kind as to introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. I'm currently visiting professor in the Department of Sociology at the London School of Economics. Previous to that, I was Professor of Urban Studies at Birkbeck, Department of Geography. My areas of research have tended to be issues around housing, regeneration, homelessness, gentrification. Those have been my areas of interest. I'm particularly interested in public housing, social housing.
And this is very much a London focus. Are you a Londoner?
No, I'm not actually. No, I'm a Northerner. Actually, I'm an expatriate Northerner.
Which part of the north?
Halifax in Yorkshire. Part of my interest in council housing is when I was 12, my family would move to council maisonette, actually up in Halifax in Yorkshire, the lived experience of council housing, if you like. So it's my mum, after my dad passed away, my mum moved to a council flat in the centre of Yorkshire, which has actually got demolished, actually, as part of a regeneration scheme. The book itself and most of my research, not all of it, I've done some research looking at housing in different parts of the southeast, but the book in particular focuses on London. So yeah, a lot of my interest has been on London council housing. My PhD looked, for example, at Camden council housing. So yeah.
Before we get into the issue around council housing and some of the themes of the book, and I admit my questions that I sent to you beforehand are incredibly broad and are basically, can you tell me the entirety of the book in 5 minutes? No. Why did you write this book now? I mean, obviously, as you say, it comes off the back of a lifetime of research looking around urban inequality, I suppose. Was there a specific motivation?
Yeah, there was. I mean, through the work that I've been doing around regeneration and housing, it became pretty obvious to me that there was a disjuncture between what I call the official regeneration narrative. In other words, then the narrative about regeneration from regeneration professionals, from local government politicians, from consultants, that essentially regeneration is a kind of win-win process. And I did some research, particularly around the Olympics, and I was looking at young homeless people living in East London. And basically the way that the Olympics was sold was that this was going to provide a lasting benefit for East London populations, and particularly then for deprived multi-ethnic East Londoners. I did some research which looked at young people living in a temporary housing accommodation, and longitudinal study. We basically looked then at how their circumstances changed in the period leading up to and after the games. And it's pretty clear that many of the claims that were made regarding the Olympics, that this was going to provide better housing, better jobs, et cetera, for local East Londoners, weren't really coming to fruition at all. And I was increasingly aware of this disjunction between the official claims around regeneration, around who it benefits, and the lived reality of deprived populations, for example, living on estates who are undergoing regeneration, basically. So that was really a lot of the motivation for writing it. I wanted to investigate that gap, as I saw it, to see if it was a real gap. And certainly my book, I think that's what I would claim, is that there is a gap between what's promised and what's delivered, really. So that was the aim.
Yeah. So I think for most younger people, there's this kind of singular piece of knowledge, which is that council houses started to get sold off into private ownership in the 80s under Margaret Thatcher's Conservative government.
Yeah.
But I suppose to foreground all of that, it would be good to have a kind of clearer understanding of what this phenomenon is, this council estate phenomenon. What are its origins? What are its characteristics?
Yeah, I mean, the origins of council housing traditionally goes back to the 1890 Housing of the Working Classes Act. And then you had, throughout the early part of the 20th century, government funding was then being introduced in relationship, treasury funding became introduced in relationship to helping to fund council house building. So you had a long sort of like, you know, gradual evolutionary development of council housing right the way up until the 1980s, basically. You had, at the national level, there was a certain degree of, particularly in the post-war period, there was a certain degree of congruence between some aspects of Labour policy and Conservative policy in the sense then, as you probably famously know, the peak year for council house building was, I think, 1953 or 54 under the Macmillan government, Conservative government. So, you know, that's often cited as an example of the way that, you know, you had what's called a Butsker-like consensus around council house delivering that both national Labour and Conservative governments thought it as being important to deliver. I mean, there were variations. It's not as simple as that. I think you could generally argue that Labour was more committed to council house building than Conservatives at the national level. Plus, the Conservatives in the 1950s did cut the sort of like the space standards on council housing. At the local level, though, it's a more kind of like interesting picture, because the local level, you can, and I've talked about this in the book, but I've written about this elsewhere, is that there was quite clear differences between the way then that Conservatives and Labour councils considered how do they view council housing. And I'm simplifying here, and this is a crude simplification, but is that Labour local authorities were generally more pro-council housing than Conservative local authorities. I mean, there are exceptions and what have you, but nevertheless, if you look at that, I've just did some work on this back last year. If you look at the data in terms of provision, generally the highest levels of council housing, geographically speaking, across the country, were in Labour-controlled areas, basically, rather than more rural, suburban areas, which tend to be Conservative areas. So there's a clear geographical distribution. So, for example, you know, the highest level of council housing in the country was actually the London Borough of Tower Hamlets. 1981, 82% of all households in Tower Hamlets were council tenants. And it was much, much lower in many rural and suburban areas, which tend to be Conservative controlled. So the local politics of council housing, because of course, one of the differences between, say, council, if you think about housing in terms of the welfare state and compare it to other aspects of the welfare state, whereas education and particularly the National Health Service, they were nationally delivered programs, basically, and services. But council housing was always dependent on the political proclivities of the local authority. So that was different from the NHS, say, for example. So that's why there's a much, as I say, the geography of council housing is much more sort of politically based, you could argue, than it is in relationship to, say, for something like the NHS. Just take a London example. If you look at London, you know, there's generally been a sort of a crude inner outer London split in relationship to the politics. Politically, inner London has tended to be more Labour. The local authorities, including the LCC, and many of the borough councils tend to be Labour. The outer boroughs were much more likely to be Conservative. And again, if you look at the geography of council housing, if you go back to the data from 1981, census data, you can see that across London, something across Greater London, something like 31% of the city was constituted by council housing. But in inner London, that was 43%. And in outer London, it was 23%. So yeah, 31% overall, but 43% in inner London, 23% in outer London. So again, if you, one of the boroughs that I look at, the Burke corner, the outer London boroughs, is Barnet. Barnet has predominantly been Conservative controlled, much, much lower percentage of council housing than you get in Labour-dominated in London authorities like Hackney or Tower Hamlets or Southwark. Southwark gained 66%. Hackney in 1981, Hackney was about, I think, 57, 58%. So, you know, Barnet, I think it was about total of about 20%. So there has been this sort of like, the distribution of council housing across the country is partly determined by local politics. Not wholly, but it's very important. And it's one of the questions that I used to sort of pose to my students is, you know, why is it the case that if you look at a map of social housing, public housing in London, you compare it with Paris, they're the obverse. So in London, what you've got is this concentration of council housing in the inner core, relatively little in the outer areas, whereas in Paris, it's the obverse. Central Paris, inner Paris, relatively little social housing. The housing tends to be in the outer arrondissement or beyond that into the banlieue outside of Paris, basically. Mm. So they're kind of so. And again, you can explain that through sort of politics. So there's a political geography to council house provision, which I think is very important, actually.
Yeah, for sure. So if the high point's the 1950s, what is the scale we're talking about in terms of numbers? Like, because obviously there's a huge amount of talk in current news about the need for house building, and it's always these big numbers. What are we talking about in terms of the actual scale of what was being done? And also, I suppose, is this specifically purpose-built? Or is it in situations like Tower Hamlets, as you're talking about, the co-opting of older stock for council purposes?
Yeah, I mean, the scale. I mean, in England, council housing peaked over 5 million dwellings in 1981, basically. And if you take the period from the 60s and 70s, you know, tens of thousands of council housing, new council housing was being built per year. It's interesting, in London, that you also had a phenomenon of what's called municipalization. Mm. Because predominantly Labour, inner London Labour councils, because they couldn't build, even though they were building quite a lot, they couldn't build at the rate to house the people on the waiting list. So what they would do is they would buy up, municipalize then private housing stock, much of which was kind of like, you know, owned by us, what you can call slumlords, basically, private landlords who didn't look after it. So you had this conversion then of all a certain number of private properties into council housing during the period in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and particularly in inner London. So again, Pitt, Camden, I can't remember the exact figures, but you're getting on for about eight, nine thousand of the council, Camden Council stock was what's called street properties. In other words, then they were houses in streets which the council basically bought up. So you have that, but you also then have estate building through council estate, basically, which is the predominant way of it being done, really. So
if it's being done by local authorities, there was no central management of the form of or type, or it was kind of, I suppose, a sort of laissez-faire approach, or was there? I mean, you mentioned the Tories, the Conservative Party, changing space standards. Was that a move away from Parker Morris, for example? Was that this idea of a kind of diffusion of responsibility, even down to design kind of forms?
Yeah, I mean, it's really different from the National Health Service. Mm. It wasn't centrally driven because local authorities were the delivery vehicle for housing. So it was different. So, for example, in architectural terms, it's one of the fascinating things about council housing is the kind of like the very large, and all there's a sort of stereotype of what the council estate is, which is a sort of stereotypical concrete brutalist deck access or tower blocks or what have you. Nevertheless, if you look at architecturally, you can see that there's a huge variation in terms of the council housing that's been produced, even in London. And again, many of at the peak of council housing, the 60s and the 70s, many of the London authorities would employ, fantastic architects. And, working on council housing during that period was very much sort of the cutting edge of architectural practice, really. So, yeah, great variation, really. Even in London. I mean, it really is a kind of, it's fascinating just if you just walk around, borough like Camden or Southwark, to see the different architectural styles of council housing that are there. But also, as I said, you've got that in terms of the estates, but you've also got the way that, as I said, many in London councils bought up street properties. Mm. So they converted these. So it's an example that I use. So, for example, if you go up to Kentish Town, where I used to live a few years ago, if you walk down from the tube station in Kentish Town, you turn to the streets on the left, Isley Street, for example. There, what you've got is, there's an estate, for example, the Peckwater Estate, Camden Council's Peckwater Estate, but you've also got, Victorian houses. And what you have then is owner-occupied houses or flats next to street properties, which are still owned by Camden Council. And Camden Council did that deliberately, partly to the bought those properties, partly, as I said, to expand their size of their stock. But secondly, they also did it in the 1960s because they were aware that gentrification was happening. So what they wanted to do was take those private properties out of the market, put them into the hands of the local authority. And in that sense, then it acted as a sort of a buffer against gentrification. So everybody says Camden's gentrified, but if Camden Council had not have done that back in the 1950s, 60s and 70s, Camden would be even more gentrified than it is now.
Yeah,
it really is a sort of people don't realise the kind of like, I don't think the long-term benefits of that in relationship to making sure that London is a genuinely multi-class city, basically.
You mentioned at the beginning there this, and I was reading about it in your book, this 1890s Act Housing of the Working Classes. And I was wondering about this issue around council housing in a post-industrial or deindustrializing and then post-industrial society. Is one of the things that's happened, because we no longer see ourselves as an industrial economy, we no longer have a kind of quote-unquote working class in the classical sense of a working industrial class, and therefore we don't need housing of that kind anymore. Like, we can rid ourselves of that.
Yeah, it's interesting. That phrase was introduced in the 1890 Act, but it was actually, Labour actually removed it in 1949. So they actually made it into sort of a general needs housing back in 1949. In terms of the relationship between, again, I'm going to contrast council housing with National Health Service. So if you take National Health Service, so that is a genuinely universalistic system in the sense that 90, 95% of the population will use health NHS services. Council housing at its peak, only got around about a third of the population. Mm-hmm. And despite the kind of like the way that the fact that Labour removed that reference to the working classes in 1949, so making it generally theoretically universalist, nevertheless, there's clear class basis to the council housing population as opposed to the NHS, which is, as I said, middle class, working class, what have you. So council housing, was predominantly, a working class tenure. But whether that's an industrial working class or a post-industrial working class, mm-hmm. it kind of doesn't really matter in a way. In terms of the kind of, I think it's not so much sort of shifts in class structure that explains it. I think it's political changes, particularly in relationship to Thatcherism, rise of Thatcherism, Blairism, et cetera, New Labour, which kind of like made a lot of a difference, really.
But before we get to this idea of the rollback years, which obviously your book addresses, because your book foregrounds the regeneration aspect, which you mentioned at the beginning, this idea of this official hegemonic narrative against reality. I was just wondering, you use this phrase, the wobbly pillar of the welfare state. Housing is the wobbly pillar of the welfare state, which is a great phrase.
Not my phrase, by the way.
No, but it's the first time I've come across it. And it seems to me that that diversity of housing types is a manifestation of the, the actual architectural styles, from the, the tower block to the slab block to the Park Hill type thing in Sheffield, or Aylesbury Estate in London, brutalist city in the sky. It seems to me that that diversity is actually a manifestation of that wobbliness, that there isn't a kind of coherent idea about what housing is and its essential value.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. I've never thought of that, but yes,
Because
that's
you
the
know you if you if you go to a hospital in Glasgow, if you go to a hospital in Cardiff, your eye operation has the same form. Your I mean
yeah.
even the spaces, even the hospital designs themselves are centrally coordinated around standards. But it's
Yeah.
strange to me that we don't have a kind of coherent idea about what
Yeah.
house is. Has that
Yeah.
been something that's been deconstructed, or what I mean, or was there ever an idea around that?
That's a really interesting question. I'm not sure there ever was a, but again, it goes to the way that council housing was, yes, it could get local government subsidies, funding through various mechanisms, but it was essentially delivered by local authorities. I mean, I think that is the key aspect of council housing. So you get this, you it variation is in a way inbuilt into the process, really. And I think, yeah, and the wobbly pillar is simply the idea then that, again, if you take the different aspects of the welfare state, post-war welfare, Keynesian welfare state, housing, education, social services, health, is that housing was less universalist. It, in a way, in the jargon, it had more of a residual population base, because it was primarily working class. And there's an argument which I probably go along with. In a way, it's because it was less universalist than the NHS or public education. That was precisely the reason why it could be deconstructed by Thatcherism during the 1980s. If it had a bigger middle class presence, I suspect it would have been less possible to deconstruct it and effectively
Get rid of it, really, in a way, hasn't it? I mean, it's
yeah. I
something.
mean, it's not get rid of. I mean, I think that's again one of the, at the end of the book, I'm keen to say, despite everything, again, even in London, there are still getting on for 400,000 households living in council housing in London, which by international standards is a huge number. Again, if you think about one of the comparisons I make is with Chicago. Chicago's obviously a smaller city than London, about a third of the size of London. The Chicago Housing Authority, its peak, 40,000. Yes. All the kind of like the hyperbole, the notoriety in many ways of the Robert Taylor Holmes projects, the Chicago projects, Cabrini Green, for example. It was only about 40. They got the maximum was about 40,000, the Chicago Housing Authority. Whereas London at its peak, 1980, 81, 800,000. And it's a huge, I mean, obviously London's a bigger city, but nevertheless, the scale of London council housing is quite breathtaking, really. And again, even today, yes, it's certainly shrunk because of all the reasons that we know. But if you walk around London, this is one of the points, again, if you think about London with, say, comparing London, public housing in London with Paris or, say, with Chicago, is that in Chicago, the public, so for example, the Robert Taylor Holmes project, that was cordoned off, if you like, by these huge expressways. It was set apart from the rest of the city. And again, banlieue in Paris are kind of like spatially set apart in suburban locations, peripheral locations. But in London, in particularly in London, it is the urban fabric. walk around where I live. In literally, I'm looking out of my window now in Islington. It's council estate on the right. There's another tower block on the left. It's based into the fabric of the city in a way which is not true for many other European cities, whereby it has been spatially or set apart, if you like.
It's a really amazing idea, actually. What I want to go back before we go to rollback, to the rollback years. What drove this? What was the ethos that drove this? I mean, you've talked about the cooperative, more cooperative form of government that occurs in the post-war years. And you've talked about the idea of, you know, for example, in Camden, the desire to resist gentrification and on a more positive interpretation, to maintain diversity of lived experiences. Was this a very distinct character to what the British state was trying to achieve through its council policy?
Yes, I think there was a great, I think, again, because I would interpret it politically in many ways, I think it was the way that the Labour Party was able to become hegemonic in certain areas. And again, a good example would be the London County Council, which was formed in the late 19th century, was disbanded in when the GLC was formed back in the mid-1960s. But one of the important points about the LCC was the way that it had a 30-year period of unbroken labour control from the 1933 up until it was abolished in 1965. Now, during that period then, because that was inner London, the LCC was able to, you know, it could politically dominate the landscape in a way, you know, which I would argue is very, very progressive. And again, you know, walk around where I live in the south of the borough of Islington, which was the old metropolitan borough of Finsbury. Mm-hmm. Again, I think there was a real commitment on the part of Labour politicians in particular to take, you know, working class people out of the terrible slum conditions that they were living in. Mm. I mean, I think that was very, a lot of it at the local level anyway, was very much a sort of political project. And I think at the national level as well, again, with sort of, you know, variations between Labour and Conservative, I think for a period in time, you know, electorally, the Conservatives going against council housing, if they'd tried to do that in the 1950s, said we're not going to build any council housing, they wouldn't have won the 1951 general election. That's certainly the case. So they had to, you know what I mean? So in other words, the Attlee governments from 45 to 51, they were able to hegemonize in the sense that they dominated the political agenda regarding council housing, which the Conservatives had to a certain extent follow in the wake of. It's a bit similar, if you like, with the later way that Thatcherism was, you know, provided a new hegemonic position, a narrative in relationship to the sale of council housing, the deconstruction then of council housing, which in many ways you could argue New Labour bought into.
Yeah, yeah. Quite like this idea. I mean, we've got the potential of communist revolution, I suppose, probably underpins it. And the British ruling classes being highly, perhaps more sensitive to that. I don't know. I just remember hearing a quote from King George V, apparently when Ramsay MacDonald was elected the first Labour PM, first Labour government. And the King was asked, King George V was asked what he thought about it. And he said, well, we're all socialists now. And I wonder whether that...
I think the kind of like the, you know, the particularly in the Homes for Heroes after the Second World, after the First World War, Lloyd George and what have you. Yes, I mean, I think that there was elements of that, a general fear amongst the British ruling class that they had to do something for the peasants, basically. Yeah. I think that was part of it. But it's not, I don't think it's just that. It's not simply top down. I think it's also then bottom up from working class people, particularly from through you know, working class parties, unions, Communist Party, Labour Party, to actually, you know, increase council house provision, basically.
So there was a bottom up petition for that.
I think it's both. It's not simply sort of like a top down we're gonna give something to the peasants, but I think it's also the combination of both of those things, basically, which again I feel helps to explain the political geography of council house provision across the century, across the 20th century.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So the rollback that, obviously, as I said earlier, you know, is associated with Thatcherism. It has longer roots, but it's accelerated very much in this kind of period, this turn towards neoliberalism. I was wondering if you could perhaps speak a little bit about that, rather than perhaps dwelling on the nuances as you, I think you've articulated them quite well in terms of the geographical texture of council house provision. What kicks off this rollback? What kicks off, what was driving this?
Yeah, I mean, go back slightly. It's important to note that there has been discretionary sales of council housing for many decades. And by discretionary sales, what I mean is that each individual local again, and this goes back to the point I was making about the important role that local authorities play. Mm. Was that local authorities could say to their tenants, "You can buy your properties from us." So they had they introduced sales programs. So prior to the right to buy, there was this discretionary sales. Again, there's political geography to that, predominantly higher into conservative areas than Labour areas, particularly in London. So what I think happened is that you know it's part of the sort of the general collapse, if you like, of the Keynesian welfare state. During the 1970s, the kind of crises that the state faced then, basically, and neoliberalism then emerges out of that sort of crisis, and Thatcherism then came upon this particular notion of the sale, what the right to buy is, in a way, it's the nationalisation of sales. Because what it means is that even if a local authority doesn't want to sell its stock, there's no possibility. They can't go against the legislation. So certain local authorities, when the legislation was originally introduced, a good example would be Norwich City Council, which was very proud of its council housing stock. It had a large council housing stock. They basically didn't, through various kind of mechanisms, they didn't enforce the right to buy, and they were basically made to do it. So what you have with the right to buy, it's a nationalization of a sales policy. So if you think about it, as I said, local authorities have got a good deal of discretion, but what the right to buy did, it took away that discretion. So they had no choice, basically. They were made to sell their stock. And the right to buy has been, so that was, key plank, it's often said to be the largest privatization that Thatcher, and probably, often people say, well, it's the most successful because it did then create, as this was the aim, the argument is that it created a property-only democracy, is that it then enabled more working class people to become homeowners. You could argue that, because if you look at the figures on this, across the UK, something like 2.8 million homes have been sold under the right to buy in the various sales programs. 1.1 million of those, about 40%, have now been sold and are now in the hands of private landlords. So you could argue then that, so there's a partial kind of creation of a property-owned democracy. But it's what Anna Minton and I describe in a paper as a private landlord owning plutocracy. That's what it's helped to create. So it's pod to plop, basically. So that's partly what it's done. Yes, it has created. There's no doubt about it. Clearly you can see this it tends to be quite a lot of anecdotal evidence on this, but you can clearly see that some council tenants who would have bought their council houses back in London, bought their houses or flats in the early 80s, they were made, if they sold it, they would make £700,000. So yes, mm-hmm. It has that shift has definitely occurred, but it's also brought all these other things in its wake, because one of the points I make in the book is that yes, you have the right to buy, but of course the right to buy gave the right to sell. Mm-hmm. So then you had the whole sort of like resales programs, and then many, as I said, roughly 40% nationally of all ex-council house, ex-right-to-buy homes are now in the hands of private landlords, basically.
Crudely, if the council housing programme of the first half of the 20th century, post-war years particularly, up to the 1980s, is about a kind of egalitarian and justice-orientated political view, which I think we could roughly say is true, is it purely an economic thing that the Conservatives sort of consolidate, centralise and accelerate? Or, I mean, do they stand to make money out of this? Is this the idea of the property-owning democracy, is that it's a kind of mechanism, an engine for affluence, which council housing is tying into bricks and mortar?
Yeah, I mean, the idea of property-owning democracy, it's a long-term... That didn't arise with Thatcher. It's a long-term conservative idea. And again, it sort of partly sort of stems from the fears around the Russian Revolution, is that if you give the working class a stake in the system, in other words, then if they could buy their own property, if they could then become homeowners, they're less likely to be socialists. They're less likely to revolt, basically. That's the kind of like the political trajectory of it. And certainly in the early period, it's one of the reasons I got interested in council housing and housing generally to begin with back in the 80s and 90s academically, was because you could see that there was some evidence that those people, those working class tenants, ex-council tenants who bought their homes under the right to buy, were statistically more likely to vote Conservative than council tenants, remaining council tenants. So I think there was a political project as part of it. And to certain, and you could argue that, again, as I said, the way then that the sale of council houses is often regarded as a quote unquote success. And that was something that the Blair government was certainly not keen to shift.
Yeah.
They kept it on, basically, because, again, my take on this is that, you know, Blair and co. Essentially regarded this as, you know, as that, you know, they would be damping, if they got rid of the right to buy, they would be damping down on working class aspirations, which was this typical arguments used against that. Mm. So why should working class people not aspire to become homeowners?
As far as I understand it, there is a strategic shift in the way that council housing sales are shifted with the rise of housing associations. For example, in Glasgow, there's a stock transfer, isn't there? So Glasgow Housing Association, make it the biggest housing association in Europe. That's not the same thing, but it pertains to the same ends?
Well, that's slightly, yeah. I mean, so...
Feel free to fully correct me.
If you take... So, I did a paper in Berlin back last year, but so I looked at the data about the contraction of council housing. So as I said, in England, so it was over 5 million in sort of 1980, roughly, and since then it shrank back by 3.4 million. Most of that is because of the right to buy and sell, so 1.9 million. But there's another 1.3 million, which is It's still social housing, but it got transferred into housing association ownership. Mm-hmm. You've also got another 143,000 demolitions. So stock transfer was a policy which was introduced mainly in the 1988 Housing Act. And that then basically gave local authorities, if right to buy was like individual privatization, you could argue then, and demunicipalization, you could argue then that stock transfer was a kind of like a collective kind of privatization or demunicipalization. I mean, housing associations are not private companies. They're in a sort of a hybrid kind of world between somewhere between, you know, public, private and voluntary, really. So stock transfer was introduced in 1988. And that was basically a vehicle then to enable those local authorities which didn't want to have council housing to get rid of it. They could then basically offload it onto the housing association sector. And again, if you look at the geography of that, most of the early sales were in rural and suburban, predominantly conservative areas. The first one was in Chiltern in Buckinghamshire, again, it speaks to the political geography, if you like, of social housing in the country. The way then that, you know, the council housing has been very much embedded in the local political level. So those conservative local authorities back in the 80s and the 90s, which wanted to basically get shot of council housing, they could do it. So they had the mechanism to do it. It's interesting because if you look at the history of this, it wasn't, so the bulk of the stock transfers from the 80s up until 1997, when Labour got in, were in rural and suburban areas, predominantly conservative areas. Not so much in inner city areas, Labour areas. That didn't occur until Labour. It was Labour then which basically pushed the stock transfer agenda even further. And there were more stock transfers, far more stock transfers of council properties under Labour, under new Labour years, than there were under the Conservatives.
Is this because of a kind of an ideological shift? I mean, obviously there was one in under the New Labour project, which is both to do with public-private partnership as a more successful form of governance, but also because of an idea about the metropolitan area as a whole. And I suppose this comes on to this idea around regeneration, where you talk about the entrepreneurial city, the presentation of the city as this new post-industrial space of entrepreneurship. And housing becomes an instrument in that, the development of that urban framing, I suppose.
In terms of stock transfer, there were two primary reasons why it was that New Labour went for stock transfers or pushed stock transfers as an agenda. One was ideological, because if you remember, New Labour was all about distancing itself from old Labour. You couldn't get anything more old Labour than council housing. So this was part of New Labour saying we are different from old Labour. We're not simply going to build estates. So they then wanted to say we're going to try something new in all kinds of ways. They were dissatisfied. They tended to use Hackney as a negative example of poor council housing management back in the 1980s and 90s. So it's basically, okay, so it doesn't really matter whether it's the council or housing association. What's important then is what works. In other words, then if you then transfer it to a housing association, you can have better management practices, better repairs, maintenance, et cetera, et cetera. So it actually benefit council housing. So that was part of the kind of the ideology. But the financing of it came from Gordon Brown and the Treasury. Gordon, because if you remember at the time, Gordon Brown was extremely keen to keep a lid on inflation. So given then that, he wanted to maintain control of the of public spending, if councils then are unable to borrow money on their stock, that will increase then the PSBR, the public sector borrowing requirement. And he didn't have control of that. So if the councils transfer it to a housing association, hey presto, it goes off the public sector, it goes off the public sector balance sheet. And housing associations then can leave in private money. We don't have to do it. So it's that confluence of the ideological aspects of New Labour with the sort of centralisation aspects of New Labour, plus then the way then, yes, they were quite happy to put in money in terms of the NHS, but they were much, much less happy to put money into this old Labour, quote-unquote, failed aspects of the welfare state, which was council housing. My take on this is that this was a disaster. That was the disaster, is that essentially they carry on right to buy, but they also then accelerated the stock transfer process. And that was a disaster. Because now you have this situation, you can clearly see it in London, whereby, lots of ex-council tenants, now housing association tenants, are up in arms about the poor maintenance and repair services they're getting from housing associations. Just to say, I don't want to paint too rosy a picture of like the pre-1980 council housing either, because one of the important factors is race. And there's a clear racialized element to how council housing was distributed, particularly in the 1945 to 1980 period. And, it's complicated, but essentially we have a position in which, for all kinds of reasons, minority ethnic groups were excluded or marginalised or got the worst council housing stock in that period. So, you have to you know, it wasn't a egalitarian nirvana.
No,
As
no,
we
I'm
came.
sure. I'm sure that, but I mean, it brings to mind this idea of the banlieue, as you've talked about on the edge of Paris, which are notoriously places where, again, ethnic minority people have been distributed to as a way of, I suppose, sort of cleansing, you know, class cleansing, ethnic cleansing, aspects of the city, again, towards this idea of a metropolitan identity and an entrepreneurial city which is sellable, I suppose, commercially sellable. I want to get this idea of the regeneration of these estates, though, because obviously that's the meat of the book. And what happens here? What's the mechanism that's going on here in terms of this regeneration?
I mean, regeneration covers a multitude of processes, to be fair. It so in terms of physical regeneration, at one extreme you have comprehensive redevelopment, total demolition and rebuilding. So that's one aspect of it. But you could also have partial demolition and rebuilding, whereby you might then refurbish part of the estate, but you might demolish another part of the estate and rebuild it, or you can have refurbishment. So there's a spectrum of physical regeneration. That's in terms of estates. But you've also got many of the regeneration programs. So, for example, a good example would be New Labour's New Deal for Communities program. It's not simply about the physical regeneration. It might have all kinds of social regeneration initiatives as part of that. So, for example, you know, improving health for a deprived population, improving, reducing crime and antisocial behaviour, improving education, etc. So, regeneration is a broad concept, and it's got different dimensions to it. And what I'm focusing on in the book is those estate regeneration schemes which have got a physical renewal element to them, in which demolition and rebuild, either partial or often total, is part of it. There are good reasons and bad reasons for doing regeneration. I think the good reasons are that, you know, many of the states, and again, this is down to central government cuts in the 1980s and 1990s, many of the states, many of the London estates, you know, were in a parlous condition. They're in a really bad condition. So, but that was a general kind of problem. Was that there was decades of disinvestment, if you like, in the stock. What estate regeneration is, it's a sort of targeted way of looking at a particular estate and reinvesting in it. As I said, and many tenants themselves, they would say, you know, they're not, many of the tenants I spoke to weren't anti-regeneration per se. They wanted to see an improvement in their estates. They wanted to see an improvement in their housing. They wanted to see an improvement in their communities and neighborhoods because they'd been neglected, they'd been disinvested in. So they wanted some kind of reinvestment, some sort of, you know, some kind of regeneration. But what they got wasn't necessarily what they signed up for, if you like. That's the issue. Is that the way that these, and I should just say that most of the estates that I looked at, the programs began during the 1990s or early 2000s. So I didn't look at any of the later schemes which have gone through the mayoral ballots which were introduced back in 2016. So, you know, so I was looking at estates which had gone, which were a particular time period. But yeah, so the dominant narrative that came across from tenants was that people often just changed their mind. They would say, you know, well, I was quite in favor of some kind of improvement. We wanted some improvement in the estate. We wanted better facilities. We wanted, you know, improved housing. We didn't want the damp, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But what they got, the demolition, rebuild, scorched earth kind of policy, brought in its wake all kinds of issues which they had never signed up for, basically. Plus, the whole thing, and again, this is particularly large estates, but, you know, even some of the smaller estates, this could take decades. If you take the Aylesbury estate, that began as a New Deal for Communities project back in 1998. The Aylesbury regeneration is not going to complete, if it completes, before 2035, 2040.
Why does it take so long? Is this to do with issues of resistance? I mean, obviously, there's been a lot of architectural resistance against the...
I mean, resistance is part of it, but it's also partly because of the... Again, I'll give you a couple of examples. Woodbury Down, the regeneration at Woodbury Down Estate up in the Manor House in Hackney, that began in 1999. That isn't due... And a couple of years ago, it was the... I went to the, it was the phase four consultation event. And that is an 8-phase scheme. It is not going to complete until 2035. So one of the interesting, and so West Endham is another estate that I spent a lot of time at. Project began in 2002. That's not going to complete until 2029. So you're talking about schemes which take decades. And the way that it's sold originally is to tenants is this is a fairly quick, painless process. And that isn't what it is.
No.
It's not fairly quick. It elongates into the never-never. And it's certainly not painless. It can be extremely painful for tenants or residents generally who are having to live through this thing year in, year out. One of the points that I often make when I give talks is, one of the central planks of regeneration, estate regeneration, is that you have to have the community involved. You have to have a process of community engagement. It can't simply be a top-down process. You have to bring the community along with you. Okay, so if you think about it, this would mean then that the Aylesbury estate, you would begin going to meetings about regeneration back in 1998, and you would be expected to carry on going to meetings every month or every 2 months for 20, 30 years. I mean, Apart from like, weird academics like me and the people who are paid to go to these events, who in their right mind would want to go sit and attend meetings about regeneration and their housing for 20 or 30 years? Nobody would.
No.
And this is what estate residents are being expected to do. And then they get blamed for non-engagement by the councils or by the consultant. Nobody turns up. I'm not surprised. Why, and the frequent refrain that you have, and again, I talk about this, I think, in Chapter 8 about consultation is, there's a massive cynicism from residents about the consultation processes.
Yeah.
Is that they say that, these are really just, they're just lip service. They're rubber stamping exercises. All the main decisions have already been made. So they just say, that they will raise issues at consultation meetings and there's no proper answer for their particular issues. Mm. And they just get ground down, disillusioned, and cynical about the process. I mean, if that was me, that's what I would do. You would just disengage.
Because
no normal person could sustain that level of engagement. At the end of the day, your home is just a base for your life. It isn't your life, for most people.
Yeah.
And then suddenly you're being expected to, hyper concentrate on this for years, decades.
It is insane, isn't it? And it accentuates that precariousness that the council house itself, the council estate itself, was supposed to...
This is supposed to look... Exactly. That's the point. That's the original point of the council house. What it's supposed to do is...
Yeah.
And this is why Labour politicians were politicians wanted to build the stuff and why people appreciated it was because it would mean that you don't have to worry about the iniquities of the private landlords, they want to kick you out or, they want to hike the rents up. You've got a security. You know what the rent's going to be. You know, it's not going to go up that much. You've got security of tenure. You can stay in it. As long as you don't murder your next door neighbours, you know, you'd probably be able to stay in it for the rest of your life, as long as you pay the rent, and the rents are affordable. Yeah. So you don't have to worry about it. But you do now.
You do now.
Exactly. Suddenly, people are like thrust into this kind of like, you know, world of you know, well, it's what Andrew Wallace, a colleague of mine, calls a limbo land. It's a sort of limbo land. People experience this psychological limbo land for years and years and years. It just goes on and on and on. And and then people disengage.
Yeah, you do document systems of resistance, and I wanted to ask about how you actually went about researching this book, because it feels almost ethnographic in the way that you've done it. And perhaps that's how you've got such a close reading of ideas of resistance. But there's that side of it. So just as the kind of demand for council housing was both top and bottom symbiotically, the resistance to this kind of regenerative, quote unquote regenerative, not regenerating some people, regenerating other people, it has to be top and bottom. So communities withstanding it. But what would be needed to change from a kind of political and a political economy background? What would be needed to kind of change this? Like, what is the solution to this problem? Because you hear in the news all the time, for example, you know, estate regeneration. Okay. So I live in Margate in Kent, estate regeneration, and you just get a whole host of ex-council residents decanted. You get weird stories where people get shunted up Stoke-on-Trent, right. You know, all over the place. You're just...
Shall I talk about the resistance first before they get onto the...
Why not?
Many of the states that I looked at, and it was an ethnographic study, basically. I attended hundreds of meetings. I was the person sitting in the back of the room, you know, scribbling notes. I attended hundreds of meetings around housing regeneration particularly intense from 2012 to 2018. London-wide meetings, but also lots and lots of estate meetings. I also informally met a lot of tenants in all kinds of circumstances. I attended various legal CPO inquiries as well. Attended some of the court eviction processes. Yeah, so it was kind of an ethnographic process. So, you know, and I say this at the end of the book in the appendix about the methods. You know, I didn't set out with a given set of, I'm going to look at X estates, and, you know, for all kinds of reasons. It was very much the estates that I looked at depended on who I met at this meeting. So I would go to meetings, you know, chat to people, and then I'd go to their estates, basically. So that's often what I did. So it wasn't, you know, I didn't have a set. These are my five estates in mind. So I think I describe it as a fairly idiosyncratic ethnographic journey, and it was in many kind of ways, you know. And it was, so that was partly dependent on literally who I met, who was kind of amenable and friendly, who I got on with, and, you know, so then, you know, go to their estates and then, you know, do the research at the estates and meet more people and go to 10 more meetings, basically. As I said, I've been to a lot of meetings on estates. In terms of most of the states that I looked at, there was some kind of level of collective resistance, collective campaigns against the regeneration that's going on. Not everybody participated, and certainly, you know, it's important to remember that some people were happy with regeneration. They wanted regeneration to happen. I would say primarily there were two groups. That's more tenants than, say, leaseholders or freeholders. The tenants who were most likely to be in favour of demolition and rebuild would be people who are overcrowded and people who were living in really, really terrible flat circumstances in terms of the maintenance. Those would tend to be the two groups who most likely say, do you know what? The people said to me, there was one guy up in Haringey, I think he was in a one-bed flat, got a family, got a couple of kids. They were living in a one-bed flat, basically. And he said, you know, I've been on the waiting list for years and years and years. you know, it's the only, literally, demolition and rebuild is the only way that I'm going to get a new flat, basically. So that was, you know, you can't ignore that was certainly, so, you know, so some people were certainly for that. But that itself, of course, speaks to the wider shrinking of the welfare, the public housing act of the welfare state. Why is it that they're waiting for years and years and years in overcrowded circumstances? Because there isn't enough council housing. So that macro picture helps to kind of like determine to some extent people's reactions. But many of the states that I looked at, as I said, you know, there was some sort of form of collective resistance, and people then would say, you know, I should just backtrack a little bit. The most of the people who were actively sort of campaigning against demolition, they weren't, you know, SWP cadres. Basically, they were just normal tenants or leaseholders who got a note through their door, said, your home's going to be demolished. And they're like, why? I don't want this to happen. Because, you know, people got, you know, attachments to the homes, to the neighborhoods, you know, and they, again, the kind of like, there's sort of like one of the dominant narratives about council housing is that this is a highly stigmatized, is that this is a very negative kind of like housing experience. You know, is that council housing is, council estates are full of crime and antisocial behaviour, et cetera, concrete jungles, a bit akin to the Robert Taylor homes or Cabrini Green in Chicago, basically, you know, which were genuinely, I think, dangerous places to live. I think London council estates, it's no doubt about it that you do get crime and antisocial behaviour, but it's highly variable on estates, varies from estate to estate. Plus, you know, I'd say most people, you know, they didn't. I came across this narrative. I interviewed nearly 200 residents. I've interviewed another 80 since. The narrative that these are, you know, criminogenic, high crime places just doesn't come across in London so much. You know, generally, a lot of people said, you know, yeah, there might be some antisocial behaviour, but generally, it's a pretty, you know, neighbourly, friendly place to live. So there's quite a lot of place attachment at the sort of community level, often a strong sense of community. So that was this kind of things which would galvanise resistance, basically. And plus, of course, you know, I should just say that there is a legality to this in terms that council tenants, they will get a secure, they will get an equivalent offer of social housing, not necessarily in the borough, but they should get an equivalent offer. Whereas leaseholders and freeholders, homeowners basically, they will just get cash compensation, but market value plus 10%. So what that means then is that they're less likely than tenants. If there is any rebuilt social housing left or rebuilt housing, the leaseholders and freeholders are less likely than the tenants to move back because the value that they, the monetary value that they get for their existing council flat or house is substantially below the level of the values on the new build, on the new build development, basically. So, you know, so yeah, yeah, so leaseholders and fields are on average, they're probably more likely to resist demolition than tenants, but many tenants do resist it. So, in terms of like what can be done, I mean, a lot of these things, you know, these issues are, you know, down to wider political economic factors, really, is that one of the things that the council say is that they simply don't have enough money to refurbish the existing properties. So in other words, demolition and rebuild becomes the go-to option. Also, I don't know if you know this, but I'm sure you do, but VAT, value-added tax, is not charged on demolition and rebuild, whereas it is on refurbishment. So it's a kind of like financial, you know, incentive to demolish. The model is that, again, in particularly in London, that because the land values are so high, potentially so high, as long as you get rid of the low rental properties, basically. So it does require a bigger shift in the model to think, you know, that the council homes should be, you know, the existing council homes, they were built at a time, they were built with political sweat and blood, but they really need to be preserved now, because the idea that you get that the private sector, if you involve, if it's a PPP on the estate, the idea that the private sector's got a big material interest in providing lots of social housing, well, it hasn't, clearly.
Are there changes afoot within GLA policy, Greater London Authority policy, towards facilitating a more holistic, a more sensitive?
Yeah, I mean, certainly that's one of the things when Kant came in 2016, was that, you know, his estate regeneration, statements basically, you know, I think he was generally aware that there were all kinds of problems in relationship to how it was estate regeneration had been conducted. And of course, Kahn introduced ballots. Now you have to have a ballot for estate regeneration. I was part of a campaign called Demolition Watch London, which we campaigned vociferously for ballots because we thought that would inject a degree of democracy into the process, which the consultation processes previously hadn't had, really. I think it's fair to say, and I spoke at the 2017 Labour Party conference along with various other housing activists, and we were arguing for ballots there. And I think it's fair to think, I don't think this is libelous to say, that I don't think that Sadiq Khan and the people around him were terribly keen on having ballots. I remember there was one of his senior people there in the room when we were speaking, who basically said, no, you don't need ballots. You can then achieve the same if you just deepen the consultation process, improve the consultation process. So, I don't think they were generally for ballot. But again, I think that was a lot of grass, not just from Demolition Watch London, but there's all kinds of other groups who were pushing for ballots. I think ballots are in principle a good idea. Unfortunately, I don't know if you saw the report from Sean Berry about ballots and state regeneration. I think the way that they've been conducted have not necessarily been always as good as it could have been, basically. So, let's put it out like that.
Well, there you go. On that contentious point, I think we'll finish. But thank you so very much, Paul. It was very, very wonderful to hear you talk.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Well, that was very good. Thanks to Paul for taking the time to speak with me, for putting so much energy into his responses. Thank you to Bristol University Press for the PDF too. The book is excellent and well worth looking at. Please see the podcast description for links to the book and to some of Paul's professional and social online identities. And thanks for listening.